From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley in Los Angeles. It's Here and Now, wishing all of our listeners a healthy and happy 2021. We start with grim news on this first day of the year. As of yesterday, more than 25,000 people in California have died from the coronavirus. That's more than the amount of seats in Los Angeles Staples Center. Hospitals are overburdened, ICUs are at capacity, and now there's a new challenge. A significant amount of frontline healthcare workers in California eligible to take the new vaccine are refusing to take it. Joining us now to put this all in perspective is Dr. Anne Ramoyne, an epidemiologist at UCLA's Fielding School of Public Health. Dr. Ramoyne, welcome back.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
Yes, thank you for being here. The Los Angeles Times is reporting that somewhere between 20 to 40% of LA County frontline workers have refused to get this vaccine. That number is higher in Riverside County, 50% there. What are you hearing about why they aren't taking the vaccine?
Well, you know, vaccine hesitancy is not something new. This is something that we've seen previously, and this is why my team at UCLA has been doing a study looking at vaccine hesitancy in health workers and first responders. I think that the key here is that healthcare workers are very importantly linchpins of the vaccination effort, and so understanding their concerns is critical. What we've understood from health workers is that this is an after effect of the politicization of the vaccine process that was perceived, a feeling that there's just still not enough information that's accessible out there to them, and a general concern about side effects, although many were not able to articulate exactly what side effects they were worried about. And it makes sense. This is all part of a lack of good information being made available to people on a way that's very digestible to everyone. It's now incumbent upon the public health infrastructure to be able to provide that information so people can make choices that will likely result in more vaccinations.
Well, as you said, frontline workers are the linchpin in helping to quell this virus. So what efforts are being made by state and local officials to overcome these concerns from these workers? Because all of the data so far has shown the vaccine is safe.
You're exactly right. All the data that we have to date, and there is a lot of data out there, show us that the vaccine is very safe and very effective and built on decades of research. But I think that the issue is that we just have not had a strong public health education campaign on this vaccine. And this should have started months and months ago. And it's very, very important to see it. It shouldn't be just from the hospitals and health systems that are providing information to their health workers, but from a national level. I think we need big campaigns. We need a lot of information out there. And people need to be able to do things like search very easily on the web and find this information. I've spent my entire career working in places like the Democratic Republic of the Congo, where we've been doing very large-scale vaccination campaigns. And I think in these types of places, the governments, the health organizations are used to doing this kind of work. We here in the United States have not been used to doing this kind of work to get people vaccinated. So it's a new challenge that we really do need to embrace.
Doctor, how concerned should we be by these numbers of frontline workers who are refusing the vaccine? Can you put this in perspective for us as we move forward in this effort?
Well, I'll give you something to think about here. And so in our own survey that we did back in September, October, we found that only 33% of health workers were willing to get the vaccine right away. Many of them wished to wait, not to be the first in line to see what happened. But after we did a second run of this survey at the end of November, beginning of December, and that changed to 66% were willing to get the vaccine right away. So they're not only the people who need to receive the vaccine first, but they're also the people who will be administering the vaccine. So it's a very important group to be able to make sure get vaccinated and also have the information not only for their own decision-making process, but so that they can communicate to others why they should get the vaccine.
That's Dr. Anne Remoyne, an epidemiologist at UCLA's Fielding School of Public Health. Doctor, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Happy New Year.
Well, let's head to Europe, where truck traffic on either side of the English Channel is practically non-existent today. Britain left the EU's vast single market for goods and services at 11 p.m. London time, midnight in Brussels, and new trade and custom rules are now in effect. For more, let's bring in NPR's Frank Langfitt, who is on the British port in the British port city of Dover. Hi, Frank, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, Tanya.
I think everyone was bracing for delays when Brexit finally took effect. What are you seeing there today?
Kind of the opposite, Tanya. It's very quiet here. In fact, I'm looking at the ramp that leads right down to the ferries, and I'm seeing about three trucks coming through. But much of the day, the ramp has been empty. And normally, New Year's is pretty quiet here, of course, but it's even quieter, and there are a few reasons for that. One is truckers have to get COVID tests now to go back into Europe because of the impact of that highly infectious variant here in England. The other thing is that there are new customs and other paperwork that people have to fill out. And so a lot of trucking companies were really nervous about disruption. And so they've kind of held back. The sorts of things they're going to need now, customs forms that they never used to have to do because these economies were so closely integrated. There are also forms to get into the county of Kent, where we are right now. And so a lot of people thought it was better to just hold off instead of sending their trucks here today.
You've been speaking with people who run hauling businesses, the companies that carry the freight back and forth. They're pretty worried about this. What are their main concerns?
I think their main concerns is not necessarily today, because it looks good today. But, you know, a few weeks down the line, they're worried that their trucks are going to be over in Europe and they may get pulled over. And they're also just frustrated with the government. The government has known for a long time they would be outside of the customs union of the European Union. And they've had this sprint in just the last 7 days, really, to get it organized. And I was talking to a guy named Rob Holliman. He's director of Young's Transportation and Logistics here. And this is what he said yesterday.
They've had 4 years to go at this. And I do find it astonishing that it's come down to the very last week of the very last year. I understand that deals go down to the wire sometimes, but not spread over such a huge period, 4 years. It's just ludicrous.
You can definitely hear his frustration, Frank. If you can stay with us, I want to bring in reporter Rebecca Rossman, who is on the other side of the English Channel in the French port city of Calais. Rebecca, Happy New Year to you as well. And what are you seeing where you are?
It's very quiet here as well, albeit a very cold day in Calais. I watched the first ferry come in from Dover this morning, and there were only 36 trucks on that ferry. Normally, I was told by customs officials here that you would see triple that number on each ship. They do say they expect things to get crazier around mid-January. I spoke with the head of the Port of Calais, Jean-Marc Puissosso, and he says he's feeling prepared for that moment. I asked how he's feeling prepared for that moment, as well as just this new chapter between France and the UK, and here's what he said.
Port is ready for the new organization and so on. So, no, I am not sad. It's life.
So he says at the end there, he's not sad. C'est la vie, this is life. Although I did see him tearing up, he claims it was because of the cold weather and the strong winds. He says France has been ready for over a year now, and the French government has hired 700 new customs officers and invested 13 million euros in new infrastructure.
Oh, wow. You know, we heard Frank talk about all of this new paperwork. Things are going to be different if you're hauling freight from Europe to your side of the English Channel over to the UK. What are these new rules and new forms that need to be filled out?
Yeah, the deal that was reached says there's no tariffs, no quotas, but new regulations means you have to fill out customs form now. So there are some estimates that 222 million new customs forms will have to be filled out every year to facilitate trade between the UK and the EU. The French government's doing what it can to make this run as smoothly as possible. They've invested 40 million euros in this new electronic system. So everything can be declared by businesses online in advance. So once you get to the port, you kind of just go straight through. You scan a barcode, you have a barcode, it's scanned by a customs officer, and you're on your way. Another thing is animal and plants crossing the channel will also now have to go through health screenings at the border.
Well, now that this divorce is final, how are people feeling on your side of the channel?
I talked with a taxi driver yesterday. He told me he thought the Brexit campaign was built on false promises that will never be met. I also saw a man fishing by the port yesterday morning. He told me he's really struggling to see how the British people voted for Brexit. And, you know, but now that we're here, it's time to accept it and move on.
Frank, I want to ask you the same question. What's your sense of how people are feeling today?
Brexit was like an eruption, Tanya. It really has changed the landscape of this country in ways that I don't think people even appreciated at the time. And so now up in Scotland, where people in Scotland voted to stay in the European Union, there's a lot of anger there. And Brexit has actually sort of breathed life into the independence movement up there. That's going to be the next challenge for the government here in the United Kingdom, is to actually hold the country together.
So much ahead for 2021, most definitely. We've been speaking with NPR's Frank Langfitt in the English port city of Dover and reporter Rebecca Rossman in the French port of Calais. Thank you so much.
Happy to do it, Tanya.
Lenny Kravitz is a lot of things. He's best known for his music as a four-time Grammy Award winner who sold millions of albums. Here are just a few of his hits. Some other fun facts. Kravitz also has his own design firm and appeared in two Hunger Games movies. So this past fall, when I heard that he wrote a memoir with David Ritz, I thought it would contain all the juicy parts of being a rock star. But no.
I didn't want it to be about fame or rock stardom or anything like that. I wanted it to be about the journey.
Lenny Kravitz's book, Let Love Rule, focuses on the foundation, the first 25 years of life that led to the man we know today. It came out in October, and Lenny Kravitz joined us to talk about it. You dedicate this book to your mother, Roxy Roker. She was well known, best known for playing Helen Willis, one half of one of TV's first interracial couples in The Jeffersons. And you write in the book that Gladys Knight's voice gave sound to your mother's soul. And man, I felt that description in my soul. But can you say more about that?
Well, Gladys Knight was one of the first voices that I fell in love with. My mother and I used to listen to records at night, and I would sing for her, stand in front of her and sing the songs that were coming off of the turntable. And one of my favorite albums was Gladys Knight and the Pips, Imagination. There was just something about Gladys and her voice that gave voice to my mother's soul.
I guess you could say that I've been lucky. Oh, I guess you could say that it's all because of you.
And if we could describe Gladys Knight's voice, it is warm, it is like comfort, it is like a cradle in many ways. And you tell these beautiful stories about your mother, how when you were a child and something would upset you, she'd bring out this magical character, Ruff Ruff. Can you tell us more about that?
She wanted me to have a way to express myself, and she knew that I wouldn't necessarily always want to talk to my quote-unquote mother, you know? So she created a character, and the character was this sort of magical dog. And what I would have to do is I would have to say abracadabra, and then she would say ruff ruff. From that moment on, she was Ruff Ruff, and she had a completely different voice, different body language. And I would spill my feelings, you know, my fears, my insecurities, my happinesses, whatever it was. And when we were finished, I would have to say abracadabra again, and then she would turn back to my mother. In retrospect, it was a brilliant way for us to communicate, and she was smart enough to come up with that method.
Yeah. Your father, Cy Kravitz, was a former military man, and he was really strict and hard on you. This book, you really illustrate how you felt he didn't understand you, but he did understand your love of music. He was the one who took you to your first Jackson 5 concert. And it was in that moment that you felt like you were actually seen by your father.
Yes.
Was it cathartic to write about your relationship?
It was. You know, we had a very challenging relationship, but that doesn't mean we didn't love each other and that we didn't respect each other. We just had a hard time connecting. And the beautiful thing about writing this book was that I was able to see my father as a character. Because when you're writing the book, everyone's a character. I'm a character. You get to back off of yourself and other people. And through seeing him as a character, I got to really understand that he was just a man trying to get through this life experience with the best that he had. And through seeing him with those eyes, any judgment that I had just began to evaporate. And it was really healing. And my love for him grew in writing this book.
You know, it was such a treat to read about all of the legendary artists you were surrounded by during your childhood. I mean, what a charmed life to have five play aunties that included Diane Carroll and Cicely Tyson. I mean, that's like the high bar for play aunties. And you say Black feminine energy is one of the reasons you've held your sanity for so long. Can you say more?
Yes, I was so blessed. My mother, my grandmother, my aunts. I felt comfortable around these women. I felt seen. I felt loved. I felt nurtured, and I felt their strength, and that fed me throughout my life. I would not be who I am or where I am in this life without that feminine Black energy.
Yeah. Another fun fact, you auditioned and were accepted into the California Boys Choir, singing classical music. What did that experience teach you?
Well, it taught me so much about music. And music that I wasn't as familiar with, classical music. It taught me so much about harmony. It opened up my ear. Being around all of these orchestras, I got to sing in the Metropolitan Opera. I did about 15 different operas. And I got to record with amazing maestros, Zubin Mehta. So being around all of that music really opened my ear and gave me an education that I use to this day. And it was heavy discipline. This was serious business.
You know, it was so fun to read about the backstories of some of the iconic moments or songs, like how Somebody's Watching Me was originally presented to you. It later became a hit for your friend, Kennedy Gordy. The chance to be a part of a group, which was going to be the Black Duran Duran Man. I mean, that it happened. In the book, it seemed like you were even surprised at your own resolve at such a young age to turn down opportunities that could have actually made you a lot of money. What do you think it was within you that made you so clear-headed about who you were and who you are?
Well, first of all, it was never about the money. For me, it was about expressing myself in a very natural way, in a true way. Now, mind you, I hadn't found my sound yet, right? So why didn't I take the deal and say, okay, I'll do this for now. And if I have success in this situation, I will develop and I'll change and I'll become who I would become. But even though I hadn't found my sound yet, I knew that what they were presenting me with was not my sound. So why even go down that avenue? I still can't explain how I had the power to do that when I was living in a car or living on people's floor or on a couch or sleeping in recording studio lounges at night. I don't know how I had the strength to do that. But every time I got close to that contract and they wanted me to sign, I felt physically ill. I couldn't do it. And I looked ridiculous to everybody. Everyone told me I was stupid and I was crazy and what's your problem? But as I learned in life, we can be presented with many open doors in our life, but it doesn't mean that you have to walk through them. And I was waiting for my door, and I'm so thankful that I did.
One of the people who helped you actually find your sound and help you find that door is Lisa Bonet. Your relationship and continued friendship is just legendary. You know, y'all need to write a book on blended families, you know, how to have wonderful relationships with ex-spouses. How did she help you find your sound?
You know, she was and is such a powerful person, a natural person, an enlightened person. And so when we met, I saw myself in her. I really feel that we were mirror images of each other. And through our friendship, because it began as a friendship, through our love, through our life, our circle of friends, the magic that was around all of us, it just enabled me to come to a place where I was finally comfortable with myself. Because remember, I'm coming out of that whole Romeo Blue phase.
Yeah, your name was Romeo Blue for a moment.
Yeah, it was an alter ego, you know, whatever you want to call it. It was a character for my music because I didn't think Lenny Kravitz was enough. So I was coming off of that phase when we met and then went back to my name after we'd met. And all of that that was going on around us in our world somehow opened a portal. All of a sudden, the sound that I was looking for was there, and I heard it, and I followed it, and that became my sound.
Well, the title of this memoir is Let Love Rule, and of course, it's also the title of your first album and one of your biggest mm-hmm. songs. Sounds like this is also how you see your life.
Yes. I mean, Let Love Rule is it. That's the statement, and it has been for 30 years, and that is the way I try to live my life every day.
Lenny Kravitz, his new memoir is Let Love Rule. Lenny, thank you so much for this conversation and thank you for your book.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. I appreciate your time and having this discussion with you.
That's Lenny Kravitz speaking with me in October. With travel restrictions and advisories in effect across the country and the world, many people are missing loved ones this holiday season. For two UC Berkeley students from Africa, it's been an especially bittersweet time. Chloe Veltman from member station KQED has their stories.
When the UC Berkeley campus shuts down for winter break, Abdul Aziz Sandotan Koulibaly usually returns home to spend time with his family in the Ivory Coast city of Mans.
Follow the traditional way, just like getting some chicken and some meat and then, you know, cook and eat together.
But not this year. The 23-year-old doctoral student in engineering is stuck in Berkeley because of the pandemic.
It has been hell. I never really thought I would have to go through something like that. And especially alone.
Koulibaly has been at Berkeley for a while. He says he made many friends as an undergrad, but they've all graduated and moved on. He stayed behind.
So starting the grad program, like, I really felt isolated.
Koulibaly has a generous scholarship, but he's had to work side jobs. He sends the extra cash back home to his family in the Ivory Coast. At the same time, he's been dealing with the racism he's encountered on campus. Like the time he overheard a couple of students say they would never date a black guy.
I never experienced that before coming to the United States.
He says it's also been tough to fit in with the school's black student groups.
Even with the people that look like you, you don't really understand the struggle that they have been through being in this country.
Koulibaly says he's reached out to his campus counsellor and psychiatrist for help. He wishes he could get more emotional support from his family, but he says there's a lot of stigma surrounding mental health issues in his home country.
The way mental health is also taken back home, you know, just like you will be fine or it's gonna pass and stuff like this. So I had a lot of like breakdown.
Roughly 1/6 of UC Berkeley's student population comes from outside the US. Unlike Koulibaly, many of these international students haven't even set foot on campus this academic year because of the pandemic. And that's brought a whole different set of challenges.
Sleeping, first of all.
That's because of the 11-hour time difference between student Idris Muhtar Ibrahim's home in Nairobi, Kenya, and his journalism classes at Berkeley.
Well, the Group A people have been working your stories.
Ibrahim's classes on Zoom typically begin at around 7 p.m. Nairobi time and run till 2 or 3 in the morning.
That's fantastic. Your stories are due today.
The 28-year-old scholarship student has also been hammered by tech outages.
In the middle of class, like, power goes off or there's no internet. It really frustrated me.
All this after doing a full shift at his day job, producing news stories for the German international broadcaster Deutsche Welle.
It's a year later, but this family is still in mourning.
Working a job and going to school, Ibrahim says the pace was unsustainable.
I would start the class like, you know, high momentum, high energy. By the time it's midnight, I'm like out. I'm done. I can't even concentrate.
As if things weren't already hard, Ibrahim came down with COVID-19 at the start of the fall semester.
And I thought I was dying, to be honest with you.
Ibrahim feels fine now and has quit his day job to focus full-time on his studies. He calls it a sacrifice, one of many he has to make this year. He hopes to make it to the Berkeley campus sometime in 2021. For Here and Now, I'm Chloe Veltman.
Today, we're saying goodbye to a year dominated by a pandemic that has killed more than 345,000 Americans and disrupted the lives of millions more. Historian Douglas Brinkley has been watching this year through his historic lens. He's a professor of history at Rice University. Welcome back to the show and Happy New Year to you.
Well, Happy New Year to you also.
Douglas, we spoke to you on New Year's Day exactly 1 year ago, and we really couldn't have imagined this year ahead, the pandemic. President Trump had been impeached, but his trial hadn't started yet. We keep saying the impact of 2020 may be unlike any other time in modern history. Is that true?
I do think it was the worst year in the 21st century. And in the 20th century, you have to go back to the World War II era for the amount of deprivations the American people had to put up with. The pandemic really caught our country by surprise. I mean, we just in 2019, we were celebrating American can-doism, that we had gone to the moon, and American exceptionalism of Neil Armstrong. Mm-hmm. And here it's 2021, and we couldn't do the Iowa caucus properly in the Democratic runoff. And then things started unspooling and February with COVID-19, and we just saw a lack of presidential leadership that seemed to continue to get worse week after week. And meanwhile, the only good news was our medical infrastructures, our heroes, people who worked in the hospitals and the medical technicians seemed to step up and at least made the year palatable. But the combo of COVID and cyber attacks and the craziness of the presidential campaign just made it an unnerving year.
Absolutely. You bring up the moon conversations. I remember that. It seems so long ago. And the Iowa caucuses, those are two stories we don't even bring up now. Thank you for bringing those up. You know, before we talk about looking ahead to 2021, let's also go back to something else. That's the impeachment trial. It was just the third in American history. It feels like a lifetime ago. How will the impeachment trial, you think, be remembered in the flurry of everything else that happened?
In the same way that the problems of Richard Nixon and Bill Clinton got remembered, meaning it's always going to be in the first paragraph of Donald Trump's biography that he joined the club of impeached presidents. He's going to wear that eye on his chest forever. And you can't shake it. He can be an ex-president of Mar-a-Lago. He could start saying all the great things that he feels he did. But that eye stands there. And then the fact that he's a one-term president, that's the L, the loser word. When you write presidential history, you try to avoid the I and the L, and Donald Trump inherited both of them this past year. And it's one of the reasons he's acting out as we enter 2021, refusing to accept Joe Biden as president. It's because he realizes that his stock's only going downward from here.
We understand what this means for him, but let's talk a little bit more about the impact on the country. There were two articles of impeachment against the president, abuse of power and obstruction of justice. He was acquitted in votes that largely fell along party lines. Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts, who presided over the Senate trial, announced the verdict on February 5th. Let's go back and listen.
The presiding officer directs judgment to be entered in accordance with the judgment of the Senate as follows. The Senate, having tried Donald John Trump, President of the United States, upon two articles of impeachment exhibited against him by the House of Representatives, and two-thirds of the senators present not having found him guilty of the charges contained therein, it is therefore ordered and adjudged that the said Donald John Trump be, and he is hereby, acquitted of the charges in said articles.
And here's another moment. After the verdict was announced, President Trump greeted cheering supporters at the White House and held up a copy of the Washington Post, if folks remember that, with the headline, Trump acquitted. Let's listen to a clip from his remarks.
This is really not a news conference. It's not a speech. It's not anything. It's just we're sort of, it's a celebration because we have something that just worked out. I mean, it worked out. We went through hell unfairly, did nothing wrong. I've done things wrong in my life, I will admit. Not purposely, but I've done things wrong. But this is what the end result is.
Douglas, was going through this process good for the country?
I don't think so in the end. It's just a more of an indication of divided government, that we're in a kind of neo-civil war now between Trump and anti-Trumpers and Democrat, meaning Democrats and some Republicans. So there's a feeling that Washington, D.C. isn't working as we head into 2021. If you get to travel around the country, you feel that some of our local governments working and some state governments have done well. There have been governors through the COVID-19 crisis who have become stars of efficiency. But by and large, one can't help feeling frustrated that Congress seems to be in disarray, if you were a Republican, you didn't want to be in a photo op with Barack Obama. If you're a Democrat, you don't want to be seen in the same frame as Donald Trump. It's not a collegiate attitude in Washington, D.C. It's warfare. And social media, I think history will point to as being the leading culprit of creating a kind of viciousness in the public square. Anybody could say anything that's crude and nasty and demeaning. You just type a few words in and you can hide behind your tweet or your post. And that happened a lot in 2021.
Yeah. You know, the pandemic response also was just so political. The choice to wear a mask or not became a political statement. I mean, we're really still in the thick of the pandemic response. How do you think history is going to judge the government's response in the beginning months of this pandemic, if we even look at it that way?
Well, we will. Everybody's going to look at when the virus hit the United States, and they will see President Trump trying to be wistfully wave the virus away. He didn't mobilize the country quickly, and lives were lost. He called himself a wartime commander in chief. Well, he failed at that for the first couple of months. We did start getting our act together. Dr. Fauci now is a figure that's going to live large in American history, representing scientific expertise against political blarney and misinformation. And Trump found some traction, and I think Operation Warp Speed will go down as a plus. The fact that Trump said, let's go now, move quickly on the vaccine, and by the end of the year, there were solutions in our midst. It's yet to be seen how the distribution of the vaccines are going to work in 2021. It's getting off to a slow start. But I'm always haunted by that number of the Spanish flu epidemic of 650,000 people dying in 1918-1919 period. Well, you know, that was back then, and we were a lot less populated country. What is the death toll at the end of the line with COVID-19? We don't know. We're hearing about new variants. We're not sure about vaccine distribution. So it's we're entering 2021 still in the midst of a really serious crisis.
With the minute I have left with you, Inauguration Day is just in a few weeks on January 20th. What does Joe Biden need to say that day in his address?
He has to heal the country. He has to use some of the soul of America rhetoric that worked well for him at speeches that he gave in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and Warm Springs, Georgia. He has to say that competence in government is here and build a real team that helps the U.S. government repair from the sort of savagery of the last 4 years. And even if you're an admirer of President Trump, a huge supporter listening, you have to admit he was trying to disable federal institutions. He was constantly at war with CIA and State Department, with the EPA and Interior. One could go down the list. I think Biden needs to become the representative of the U.S. federal government working at its best on the behalf of the American people and listening to the scientific community, because they have our answers.
Douglas Brinkley is professor of history at Rice University. Thank you for speaking with us again this New Year's Day. And again, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Thank you for the privilege.
Anne Davila Cardinal was born in the U.S., but she has a deep connection to her mother's homeland, Puerto Rico. Cardinal's first two horror novels for young adults were set on the island. As John Kalish reports, the author wants to take readers to a world they may not know, one of fantasy and reality.
Anne Davila Cardinal grew up in New York and New Jersey. She says she was mugged 3 times before she was 8. Then her father died and her mother started drinking heavily. Her escape was horror movies and magic realist novels from her mother's bookshelf.
And I had nightmares. I mean, it definitely affected me, but it also made me feel better about my life. When you're reading a horror novel, it's like it justifies so much fear, but at least when you're done, there's no zombies.
The supernatural permeates Cardinal's novels.
They don't look like zombies. I'm thinking ghosts.
In Category 5, the protagonist is a Vermont teenager named Lupe, who along with her friend Javier investigates a series of deaths in Puerto Rico.
She turned around to look at Javier, the blue of the supernatural being sparkling in his eyes. He nodded. Definitely fantasmas. The glow was moving away en masse into the trees in the distance. Are we going to follow them? Javier asked. Lupe looked around. They had no flashlights, no water, and the Lord knew if the swarm was dangerous or not. Nah, I'm curious, not stupid. Let's go back and tell my uncle.
Her uncle is the police chief, based on Cardinal's own uncle who works in law enforcement in Puerto Rico. In the author's first young adult novel, Five Midnights, Lupe is again investigating strange murders.
Somebody asked me why I don't write crime, and I said if there's a body in my book, I want it to get up again. I want to write about the fantastic. It's the same reason I was obsessed with magical realism as a child. Growing up in a Latin culture, you accept the fact that the supernatural is not necessarily an outrageous concept. There is no question there are ghosts.
In addition to ghosts, there's a good dose of reality in Cardinal's fiction. Category 5 is set in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria's devastation of Puerto Rico in 2017.
What I find so compelling about her work is that it's part of a large vision of a troubled Puerto Rico that's worth fighting for.
Rigoberto Gonzalez is a professor at Rutgers University in New Jersey. Gonzalez is a Chicano who grew up in the U.S. but writes about Mexico. Speaking via Skype, he calls Cardinal an immigrant writer who is part of the Puerto Rican diaspora, despite the fact that she was born in the U.S.
People can be in the United States, they're still writing about India, they're still writing about any place in Latin America, they're still writing about Europe. She's part of that. Her lineage is part of that. And I think that when you leave your homeland, you have your homeland in your heart.
When Anne Davila Cardinal was a kid, her mother would send her there for the summer, and she still returns every year. Cardinal refers to herself as Gringa Rican because her father's side of the family is from Europe.
I often address the issue of being between two cultures because that's what I grew up with, and I want to reach kids who are dealing with that. That is getting to be more and more the story. You know, we're all mixed race and ethnicities and cultures, but you feel not at home in either, and so it was important to me to deal with that.
And not just in her novels. During the daylight hours, Cardinal is the director of recruitment at Vermont College of Fine Arts and has also helped create a writing residency through the school in Puerto Rico.
The thing I want most is to connect with young readers, particularly those undergoing situations like I had. When you're young, it can very often feel like you're going through things alone. And so it means a lot to me to be able to maybe make that connection, that there are other people out there who have experienced similar things and have survived.
Anne DeVia Cardinal's next young adult novel is a horror rom-com. She's also working on an eco-horror novel set in Puerto Rico. For NPR News, I'm John Kalish.
So, does today feel any different? We attach so much symbolism to the moment when one year becomes the next, but it's part of the human condition to want to start over, to refresh, reassess, and reset. And we hope that this is a new beginning for you, and the first day of, we hope, a much better 2021. Also on this first day of January, we want to thank the members of our team who are working on this holiday. Christina Kim, Tinku Ray, Alexander Turk, Lynn Menegon, James Trout, Chico Theori, James Mastromarino, Samantha Rafelson, Chris Bowman, Marcel Hutchins, Ashley Locke, Alex Ashlock, Jill Ryan, Mike Moschetto, Serena McMahon, and Todd Munt. You can also meet our whole team at hereandnow.org. Just click on Meet the Staff. And there's one special person we'd also like to recognize, Cassidy Rosenblum, who after 2.5 years producing for the show is moving on to something new. Her beat, so to speak, encompassed a lot of international stories, business and economic news, and technology. But like everyone else working on a news show, Cassidy knew how to become an expert on a topic in just one day. And then the next day, an expert on something else completely different. Cassidy is planning to take her journalistic skills in a new direction, long-form writing. So make sure to watch out for her byline, which is coming your way soon. Cassidy, we wish you the best of luck, and it's been a joy to work with you. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley. Happy New Year. It's Here and Now.